good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. On Unwelcome Guests, we regularly cover the lack of real democracy in our society and the way corporate capital has colonized not only other nations but also our own. Rural communities and the small-town way of life have been slated for extinction by this same system. While the image of rural life becomes a subject for Disney theme parks, real rural communities are becoming depopulated, denuded garbage dumps, not by accident, but as a direct result of corporate-dictated government policy. Tonight we're going to look at two facets of this. First, Al Krebs will talk about the assault on the family farm by agribusiness interests and the role that global trade agreements play. The goal is to export farm work and import farm product, as has already been done with manufacturing, and to concentrate ownership of agricultural production into the hands of a few agribusiness conglomerates in the name of efficiency. This is the same efficiency that has given us strip malls, chain stores, and low-wage, dead-end work. We'll present a special report from the mountains of West Virginia, where coal companies are literally leveling mountains, burying waterways, and poisoning wells in order to maximize their profits, while poverty in those communities deepens. And we'll hear a commentary by Michael Parenti on why we must fight City Hall.
By stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black bits.
The following talk by journalist and activist Al Krebs was given in Seattle, Washington last fall, prior to the meeting and protests of the World Trade Organization.
Next speaker is Al Krebs. He's director of the Corporate Agribusiness Research Project in Everett. He is editor-publisher of the weekly email Agribusiness Examiner newsletter. Both are devoted to monitoring the activities of corporate agribusiness from the public interest perspective. He is the author of The Corporate Reapers, The Book of Agribusiness. He's a native of California and a journalist and has been a public interest advocate for over 38 years. Please welcome Al Krebs.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to spend a little time tonight talking to you about beef and bananas. Which are two of the most common items that we find in our shopping carts. But I want to, before I do that, I want to take advantage of the academic surroundings and give you a quick offer you a quick little history lesson. Studs Terkel often says that we can't say where we're going if we don't know where we've been. And I think that is particularly important when it comes to issues of trade and agriculture and farming. Back in 1971, when the Nixon administration decided to let the currency float and not redeem foreign dollars in gold, why, the U.S. entered its first trade deficit, which has been mounting ever since. And in that process of doing that, they set up a Williams Commission, it was called, in terms of trying to get to the root of why we had a deficit in trade, and yet agriculture showed a surplus in export. And they set up the commission, and members of the commission include several prominent folks from corporate agribusiness, including the head of Del Monte Corporation, and also at the time the vice president of Cargill Incorporated, Cargill being the nation's largest private corporation and the world's largest grain trader. And out of that commission came a term that we've been stuck with ever since called comparative advantage. In other words, the world should be divided up into those countries that produce things that they have the advantage in producing. Well, when it comes to food, that puts the U.S. pretty far ahead of the rest. And it also divides up the labor situation to where we put the third world countries or the south countries into the labor intensive, but where we put the north into the technological age of agriculture. Consequently, we depend upon the third world countries depend upon their cash crops to get money so they can turn around and buy grain and so forth from the developed nations, particularly the United States. Consequently, with the comparative advantage working, we've got to gear our agriculture and our trade policies to conform to that. And by doing that, we have allowed ourselves to become what Henry Kissinger calls economic imperialists. So in the process of doing this, the person that drafted the recommendations, these recommendations to give to the Nixon administration, was a man by the name of William R. Pierce, who was, as I say, was the vice president of Cargill. Pierce later went on to become our trade representative and our chief trade negotiator. In the process of doing that, in 1972, Nixon's Council on Economic and International Economic Policy was to develop the strategy that they were going to put before GATT to make it, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, to make it easier for the United States to exercise its power in trade. And they were successful in doing that. And they, by what they had to do, in terms of getting the support not only for farmers in this country, but farmers abroad. They had to remove that, get the price as cheap as possible so we could sell abroad, ignoring the fact that we only export about 25% of what we actually produce. So if there's ever a more classic case of the tail wagging the dog, it's in terms of agricultural exports, because we're letting the price that we're trying to set at 25%, we're letting that set for the other 75%, and in the process, we're driving our family farmers out of business. So in looking at that brief history, and it's very brief, believe me, we can see where we've come up to a point now where we encountered here a few years ago the European Union, because the European Union has always been kind of a thorn in our side because they still support their family farmers. And since the objective of agricultural policy in this country since the turn of the century has been to get rid of, in their terminology, excess human resources, meaning farmers, why they needed to somehow get those policies abroad so we wouldn't have to be supporting farmers abroad. Fortunately, the Europeans have rejected that and have stood by their family farmers because they realize, as we should be realizing, that the family farm is still the most efficient agricultural producer of food that we have in this world. So when the European Union, when we, back in about 10 years, 12 years ago, decided that the beef that was being imported into the European Union was unsafe because of the hormones that were being added to the cattle here in this country, they put a ban on the beef, imports of beef. We said it was an unfair trade practice. And we took it to the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which was the predecessor of the WTO. And we got a ruling on it that it was somewhat of an ambiguous ruling, but the Europeans kept the ban on, and they've kept it on to this very day. And as you know, if you've read the papers, that we have levied tariffs, 100% tariffs, against a lot of imports that are coming into this country from the European countries. The Europeans say that the hormones are unsafe. We say it's simply protectionism. Unfortunately, the scientific evidence is still out to lunch on the definitive decision, although the European Union Scientific Commission came back here just a couple of months ago with saying that one of the hormones is definitely carcinogenic. And we, of course, immediately poo-pooed the whole idea and said that this was just a poor science and everything. Of course, in this country, we've seen over and over again where we have the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Food and Drug Administration simply approving something and then asking questions later, and then coming to find out of the disastrous effects that some of these things that they've approved at have, but they are not around to pick up the costs. The taxpayers have to come in and pick up the costs in terms of medical expenses. So the European Union decided we're not going to have any of this. And the thing that kind of made the decision on it was one of the growth hormones that was being given to the cattle was DES. And some of you may remember DES in terms of the cancer problems that it was causing, particularly in women and children. And so they've held pretty much. We have admitted in the process that we have never tested the hormones on human beings. We've only tested them on animals. And we tend to use that rationale for our justification that we're that the European Union is engaging in an unfair trade practices. The situation as it stands right now is the tariffs are in place, the European Union is appealing, we've appealed, and the WTO has demanded that the European Union take off the ban. The Europeans are holding fast, they're not about to give in. Now, in terms of bananas, I'd like to pass on to you something. Some of you may have seen this, but it was a documentary on PBS a few years ago, and it was called So You Want to Buy a President. And in the process, the opening of the program was very effective. And I'd like to read you just a brief excerpt from that opening script. The moderator of the program, the commentator on the program, was Robert Krulich. And he said, some of you might have missed this on television this past fall. It was a primetime broadcast of a gala fundraiser from Ford's Theater, the place where Lincoln was shot. And in the front row is the President of the United States, and up on the stage was the comedian Paula Poundstone. And she was trying to figure out who gets to sit next to the President. Paula Poundstone, what determines who gets which seat? Do you do the whole seating chart? Do you know who's behind your head there very well? Who is that? And I must say that this whole dialogue, of course, is sprinkled with a lot of laughter and applause. The guest hostess who's seated in the audience next to the President, Carl Lindner. Paula Poundstone, Carl Lindner. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar. All right, what made you give him that seat? All right, now tell us, who is it? Hostess, a whole lot of money. And there's a lot of laughter. Paula Poundstone, a whole lot of money. Carl, I'm sure it was much deeper than that, sir. It was money and love, little buddy. Don't you worry. What's Carl's role in the community? Carl, why do you have so much money? Is that rude to ask? Sir, what do you do for a living? I know I should know, but since I don't know, would you tell me? Mr. President, do you know who Carl Lindner is? Clinton nods, yes. Paula Poundstone, would you mind telling me? President Clinton, it's a secret. Paula Poundstone, it's a secret. President Clinton, he's in bananas, sort of like you are. Paula Poundstone, he's in bananas. Is that true, sir? He's what? He's the Chiquita banana guy. Gee, sir, without the fruit on your head, sir, I didn't recognize you. Is that true? Why does the president know the banana guy? And then Robert Perlich, the moderator, says, there's an interesting question. Why does the president know the banana guy? Well, Carl Linder is head of Chiquita International. Chiquita International is a successor to a company called United Brands, which was a successor to a company called United Fruit Company. And anybody that knows the history of the Americas in the 20th century knows that we've been using the U.S. Marines and the CIA to impose our will and impose Chiquita Banana and United Fruit and Standard Steamship and Dole and Del Monte in Latin America and Central America. And it's just been one interest. The term Banana Republic doesn't come haphazardly. It's a very apropos term. So what happened was the European Union was bringing in bananas from basically their former colonies in the Caribbean, the Windward Islands and so forth. And Chiquita and Dole and Del Monte, the three big exporters who have close to 70% of the world market in bananas, they wanted to bring in their bananas that were a little cheaper and would undercut the bananas that were being brought in from the Caribbean countries. Now, to understand the Caribbean countries' interest in this, you have to realize that 17% of the gross national product is based on bananas. Over almost 50% of their exports are in bananas. So when you take away that market, you take away a big chunk of the economy in those islands. And meanwhile, you've got the three big banana producers, led by Chiquita, who has 27% alone of the world's banana market. They're the ones that come in and take over that banana market. And the Europeans said, no, we're not. Some of the European countries said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to keep trading with these countries, help these 40 to 50,000 banana growers in the Caribbean and everything over the banana producers that the Chiquita and Dole have in the Central American countries. Consequently, when they went to WTO, WTO said, no, you've got to revise the policy. Interestingly enough, they've gone through several disputes. I think it's the third time now that WTO says that they have to do this. But the original complaint that was launched by the United States, now mind you, the United States really has no proprietary interest in this thing. We don't grow bananas in the United States. And yet we took the side of Carl Linder. And the day after, if you want to know why we took the side of Carl Linder, the day after, Mickey Cantor, who was our U.S. trade representative at the time, filed a complaint with the WTO, Carl Linder and the executives of Chiquita Banana poured $500,000 into the Democratic Party's coffers in 14 different states around the country. So in a sense, what this whole banana dispute is about, when it comes right down to the basic element, it's Clinton paying off a campaign debt to Carl Linder. It has very little to do with what we would call a trade issue. It's just simply out and out greed. And Carl Linder has a reputation of being, a past reputation of being one of the largest donors to the Republican Party. But he got his way with Clinton on the banana thing. So we have taken up the cause for Carl Linder. And the justification by the WTO for even getting involved in this mess is that even though we don't provide, even though it's not an American company that's producing and exporting those bananas, it is, I say it's not America, it's an American company, that they are in a sense servicing. It's a service that's provided. And that comes under the WTO regulations of governance of by WTO. So they've been able to use that effectively. They've also, again, imposed tariffs on the Europeans for doing this. Unfortunately, it looks like there may be a compromise that's being worked out right now, the Germans being in the forefront of this, where they will give in and give the allow the Chiquita bananas to be sold to the exclusion of the Caribbean countries. The Caribbean countries, meanwhile, have said very directly to us, well, you do that, and we're going to have to rely on some other kind of cash crop. And the best cash crop we know of is marijuana. So much for Bill Clinton's war on drugs. But it, in a sense, it shows you basically how hypocritical this whole thing is. Not only is it hypocritical, but these basic issues that are involved in this thing are not getting to the public in general. And that's our job, is to get these issues out to the public and everything, because the media is become as bad as corporate agribusiness, and or as bad as any of the big corporate sectors, because it's all owned by the corporations, you know. And a good example of this is about a year ago, the Cincinnati Enquirer did a detailed expose on Chiquita International. Unfortunately, the reporter that did the series, Mike Gallagher, happened to steal some voice tapes from Chiquita to do the thing, and was put in jail for it and fined for it. However, in all the denials and in all the publicity that surrounded this series of articles, never once do you find in there where there was a statement by Chiquita that the facts in the story were wrong. It's simply he stole the voice tapes. And that was the issue. But that's the way the media reported it, and giving the inference to the fact that somehow this discredited the whole story, when it that wasn't the case at all. And you would have thought that the media itself would be the ones that would stand up and say, well, listen, you know, sure, this guy wasn't quite ethical in how he did this, but still the facts remain. But they didn't. That isn't the way they played it. And as a matter of fact, the Cincinnati Enquirer, 2 weeks after the series ran a front page editorial apologizing to Carl Lindner and settling for $10 million when Chiquita hadn't even filed a lawsuit against them. You know, of course, it just so happens that before the Cincinnati Enquirer became a Gannett newspaper, guess who was the owner? Carl Lindner. So, I mean, those are the kinds of things that are going on all the time. And they have a direct bearing. The item that appears in most people's shopping carts are bananas. Next to that is meat. So when we see these things, we've got to understand that no longer can we just put food aside as treating it as a separate thing. It's very interconnected to the whole oppressive system that we've got in the world that's called the corporatist culture. And we've got to understand that eating has become a political act. What we eat, why we eat, and where we eat. And by doing that, by looking at alternatives, by looking at sustainable agriculture and other ideas, organic agriculture and things like that, we can develop a system A longtime friend of mine in California used to say, what we've got here is a drunken dinosaur that's kind of wandering across the landscape. And we've got to build a cocoon or a shell strong enough that when that dinosaur decides to squat, it's going to hurt the dinosaur more than it's going to hurt us. The problem is now, the dinosaur can squat and not even know it's squatted. And that's, I think, what the issue has got to be in the coming WTO round, is we don't need any more ideas on the table about agriculture. We need to straighten out the mess that's already on the table, and we need to identify the people. As Michael Moore says, we got to start taking names and addresses. When the European Union first set up the arrangement in terms of, there was about, I think there was three countries that were willing to accept, two or three countries that were willing to accept what they called the dollar bananas, the Chiquita bananas. And then there were two or three other countries that didn't want to do that. And they more or less held the day in terms of that. That's why the European Union as a whole has not endorsed the thing. Now, it has been proposed that to let both bananas, in other words, let both the Central American bananas, the dollar bananas, and the Caribbean bananas come on. But that's even been opposed by Chiquita. They don't want that. And the thing about it is, when the Berlin Wall fell, Chiquita saw that this was going to be the opening of a gigantic market in Eastern Europe for bananas. And they overextended themselves. And that's the worst thing you can do with the stockholders. Because if you're bringing in 15 to 20% return on investment every year, and then suddenly you've got to justify to the stockholders that you're not bringing in that anymore, you know, why, you're in big trouble, you know. So that's why why Chiquita is so insistent about that they should have the market to themselves, is so they can make up for this thing. And interestingly enough, Dole and Del Monte has both said, we can live with this, you know. Matter of fact, Dole even said that their market shares improved since the Europeans have put in the restrictions on the dollar banana. So it just comes back to Chiquita. Chiquita is the culprit here. And there's one thing I want to pick up on, if I can. In terms of as I said, naming names and taking addresses on the things, we've got to stop, I think. I'm not too fond of the term multinationals, because 50 of the largest 100 corporations in this world are American corporations. And when you look around and you see the corporate structure and who is more or less calling the shots, it's the American companies that are doing it, you know. It's our own companies. And we've got to make them accountable. You could go up to anybody on the street and say, who's Shell, and who's British Petroleum, and Exxon, and so forth, and they could tell you right away. If you went up on the street and said, who's Cargill, who's Dreyfus, who's Bungie, who's ADM, you know, most people wouldn't know, you know. And yet those companies have more of an impact on our daily lives than the oil companies have on it. So we've got to start naming names on that thing. When I said Cargill before, I didn't follow up on a point that I should have made. After Pierce was successful in getting this comparative advantage through, and then getting the Farm Bill in 1975 through, that began to reduce the price that farmers got paid for what they did, there was still this problem of price supports, which was keeping a lot of our farmers alive. And that, the final nail in the coffin, was driven back in 1995 when we passed the so-called Freedom to Farm Bill, which has been a total disaster for our farmers. And that bill was by and large drafted by a man by the name of Daniel Amstutz, who also happened to be a vice president of Cargill. Now, both of these men, when they finished in the administration, and Amstutz, by the way, was also the man that basically laid out the blueprint for the Uruguay round of our trade talks in terms of agriculture. Both those men went back to the Cargill corporate structure. Who is one of the three major companies that ship meat to the Europeans? Well, the three major companies that control 81% of our meat shipments, or our beef packing in this country, are IBP, Conagra, and Excel, which is a subsidiary of Cargill.
Go ahead. She's asking, where did the hormones come from that are injected into the beef?
Yeah. Well, to begin, first of all, let me say that they're approved since the Europeans have put in the restrictions on the dollar banana. So it just comes back to Chiquita. Chiquita is the culprit here. And there's one thing I want to pick up on, if I can. In terms of, as I said, naming names and taking addresses on the things, we've got to stop, I think. I'm not too fond of the term multinationals, because 50 of the largest 100 corporations in this world are American corporations. And when you look around and you see the corporate structure and who is more or less calling the shots, it's the American companies that are doing it, you know. It's our own companies. And we've got to make them accountable. You could go up to anybody on the street and say, who's Shell and who's British Petroleum and Exxon and so forth, and they could tell you right away. If you went up on the street and said, who's Cargill, who's Dreyfus, who's Bungie, who's ADM, you know, most people wouldn't know, you know. And yet those companies have more of an impact on our daily lives than the oil companies have on it. So we've got to start naming names on that thing. When I said Cargill before, I didn't follow up on a point that I should have made. After Pierce was successful in getting this comparative advantage through, and then getting the Farm Bill in 1975 through, that began to reduce the price that farmers got paid for what they did, there was still this problem of price supports, which was keeping a lot of our farmers alive. And that, the final nail in the coffin, was driven back in 1995 when we passed the so-called Freedom to Farm Bill, which has been a total disaster for our farmers. And that bill was, by and large, drafted by a man by the name of Daniel Amstutz, who also happened to be a vice president of Cargill. Now, both of these men, when they finished in the administration, and Amstutz, by the way, was also the man that basically laid out the blueprint for the Uruguay round of our trade talks in terms of agriculture. Both those men went back to the Cargill corporate structure. Who is one of the three major companies that ship meat to the Europeans? Well, the three major companies that control 81% of our meat shipments, or our beef packing in this country, are IBP, Conagra, and Excel, which is a subsidiary of Cargill.
Go ahead. She's asking, where did the hormones come from that are injected into the beef?
Yeah. Well, to begin, first of all, let me say that there has been a system worked out where they can detect what is hormone-fed beef and what is not hormone-fed beef. And that the Europeans say, all right, if you want to bring in hormone beef, added beef, simply label it. And guess what? We're pulling the same thing there that we're pulling on the genetically engineered stuff. We don't want it labeled. I say we, Cargill and those, don't want it labeled. Because as an official of Monsanto said a few years ago, if we start labeling food that it's genetically engineered, it's like giving it the kiss of death. So what the thing about it is in terms of one of the things, and I didn't find this out until just here recently, is one of the hormones that's given to the cattle is to simply keep them calm, because when you get large numbers of animals together like that, they tend to get unruly, and you destroy the animal. The animal gets destroyed by the other animals and everything. So if we go back to the idea of in terms of sustainable agriculture, raising, for example, cattle on grass instead of feeding them so much corn and taking natural protein and to create one unit of unnatural protein, if we get back to that principle, but that's undermining the Cargills and the IBPs and the ConAgras, you know. They want these large farms where they can pack these things in. And if we ever need an example of the long-term disastrous effects of that, all we have to do is look at North Carolina right now. Because what we're seeing in North Carolina are these waste lagoons. And we're talking waste, folks. You know, a hog produces 8 times more waste than a human being. And right now, afloat in North Carolina, is there the waste that's equal to the human waste of the state of Texas. You know, and it's from these large hog farms that's set up in North Carolina, and the lagoons have been, and we've been, and I can say this with some authority behind it, we've been saying that this was going to happen for the last 7-8 years, and now finally a few people are starting to listen. Although again, the media today, there was an Associated Press story finally coming around to saying what the hog lagoons are causing, the troubles are causing in North Carolina. Before, it's all been Floyd. A lot of the disaster that's going on in North Carolina now is not Mother Nature, it's mankind.
That was journalist and activist Al Krebs speaking on the destruction of the family farm. Thanks to Mike McCormick of KCMU Radio in Seattle, who provided that tape to us.
When the whistle blows each morning, and I walk down that cold, dark mine, I say, pray to my dear Savior, please let me see the sunshine one more time. Well, when will it be over? When will I lay these burdens down? And when I die, dear Lord in heaven, please take my soul and make that cold dark ground.
Next on Unwelcome Guests, we're going to be speaking about a new kind of coal mining called mountaintop removal, which has received some national media attention recently, with coverage in the Washington Post, the New York Times, and 60 Minutes, among other places. We wanted to get a local and activist perspective on the issue, so we're going to be speaking with Randy Boyd, an activist with the Plateau Action Network, which is a watershed association for the New River Gorge National Park in the southern coal fields of West Virginia. Welcome to Unwelcome Guests.
Thank you, Chris.
So why don't you start out by telling us what mountaintop removal is?
Okay, mountaintop removal is different than strip mining. Let me just give a little brief history of coal mining in West Virginia. West Virginia for the last 100 years has either led the nation or been in the top 2 or 3 states for production of coal. And back in the 70s, a new type of mining started up. It was called strip mining, basically where they go to an area and take large bulldozers, strip all the topsoil off, and get the coal. And here in about the last 10 or 15 years, technology has increased to where they take off the whole tops of mountains. Sometimes they'll take a 3,000-foot mountain down to 2,000 feet. And it's usually just thin layers of coal, but what makes it so bad is they might do that to get 2 feet of coal, but they have to take the other 998 feet of what they refer to as spoil and put it somewhere. Mm-hmm. And where they put it is in the streams and the hollows and the valleys, and that's called valley fill. And for instance, the machines that they use to do this, the typical drag line is 30 stories high, and the bucket that scoops this material up is 3 stories high, bigger than a 2-story house. It's about a $100 million machine, and it's just devastating the environment, devastating communities, and flattening our mountains. And West Virginia is a mountain state. That's our heritage. It's mountains. Right.
Yeah, well, so maybe you can talk a little bit about what the environmental effects.
Well, it has illegally buried 700 miles of streams. It's also in 5 southern West Virginia counties. Close to 20% of those southern counties have been, of the landmass in those counties, have been flattened by this mountaintop removal. It totally destroys the wildlife. No topsoil is put back. It looks like a moonscape. Mm-hmm. They do, some of the areas have been, quote, reclaimed, but all they can do is plant grass. The ex-head of the Division of Forestry in West Virginia, a fellow by the name Bill Maxey, who he was head of the Division of Forestry for 20 years, mm-hmm. who was often criticized by environmentalists, actually resigned over the mountaintop removal issue because he said he had been asked to lie by the governor's office about the effects of mountaintop removal. He'd been asked to say that you can, you know, go in there and replant trees and have timber. And he said, quote unquote, planting trees in the mountaintop removal sites like planting trees in concrete, they won't grow.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So I want to talk about the effects on people and on communities, too. But before we get to that, maybe you could just talk a little bit about when you said it was illegal, they were sort of illegally dumping this stuff into the valleys. And the
well,
streams.
If you go back 20 years to the surface 1977 Surface Mining Reclamation Act, that came as it's a federal law. It came in the result of a lot of concern over strip mining in the coal fields of Appalachia. And this law was created after much debate and trying to balance economic interest with interest in the environment. And what this law said when you surface mine an area, a mountain, you have to bring it back to what they call approximate original contour. In other words, you have to take the dirt that you remove and put it back and try to approximate the contour of the mountain before they took it off. And that's federal law. And in West Virginia, that's never been followed. Mm-hmm. In 20 years, there has not been one site that's been put back to approximate original contour. So that's one law that's been broken. And when the state's largest environmental group sued not only the state of West Virginia, but the Federal Office of Surface Mining and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, they settled that issue because they didn't have a leg to stand on. Now, you can get an economic variance to take off the top of a mountain under the SMCRA law. And that makes sense because let's say you want to put an airport somewhere and you take off the top of the mountain, you got an airport. Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense. So you can apply for an economic variance. And 80% of all the mountaintop removal jobs that didn't bring it back to approximate original contour out of those 80%, none of them applied for an economic variance.
They didn't even bother.
And the state didn't make them do it.
Wow. Yeah.
And the 20% that did, most of them applied for an economic variance, not for airports,
mm-hmm.
not for schools, not for shopping centers, mm-hmm. but for fish and wildlife enhancement, which is not recognized under SMCRA as an appropriate economic variance. And it doesn't make any sense. You take the top off of a mountain, strip all the trees, strip all the topsoil, in many cases don't plant anything back, in some cases plant grass back, and they call that fish and wildlife enhancement. So that was another area where the law was broken. And probably the and that was also settled out of court because they knew they didn't have a leg to stand on. The other area that did go to court, went to federal court, was the Clean Water Act states that it's against the law to fill a stream and or an intermittent or perennial stream. A perennial stream is a stream that flows year-round. Intermittent stream is a stream that flows more than 6 months out of the year. And Ken Ward, an award-winning reporter for the Charleston Gazette, he's won over 10 national awards covering this story. He's the one that dug most of this up. He found that that in the last 20 years, over 700 miles of streams in West Virginia have been buried illegally.
Wow.
And they took this to court, and federal judge Charles Hayden, who, by the way, was a Republican-appointed judge who often sides with the industry, ruled that state of West Virginia and the Federal Office of Surface Mining had illegally allowed the coal industry for the past 20 years to fill these streams. And, you know, this created a lot of controversy in the state. In fact, he used the term, the argument that the State Division of Environmental Protection was using, it was absurd, their whole argument. And when this ruling came out, it was, the state's response was, Chicken Little, you know, the sky is falling. Our governor said, this ruling stops all mining in the state of West Virginia, which it didn't. He said it stopped road building in the state of West Virginia, which was clearly spelled out in the judge's decision. It didn't. It stopped any development of malls. It didn't. He put a 10% spending freeze on the whole state, and it was all just a big scare tactic.
Mm-hmm. To make people think that it's too economically costly to protect the stream.
Right.
Why don't you tell us about the effects on the mountaintop removal has on the people who live nearby?
Probably the biggest effect are the explosions that these people have to endure. Under West Virginia state law, they can set off explosives for these mountaintop removal jobs within a quarter of a mile of someone's house. When you consider that an average shot or average explosion is about 10,000 pounds, this creates huge problems for people. You have an explosion of that magnitude that close to somebody's house, it creates dust, breaks people's windows, it ruins their wells. There are hundreds of documented cases of people's wells being ruined by this.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, at a legislative subcommittee hearing last year, West Virginia legislature on mountaintop removal, the figure was given that 311,000 tons are detonated, tons of explosives are detonated annually in West Virginia. Now, Chris, the size of the explosion that blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City was 1.5 tons. And there's 55 counties in West Virginia. That's enough explosives to have an explosion the size of the explosion that blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City every day of the year in all 55 counties in West Virginia. But at the same time, most of these explosions are detonated in only about 10 counties, mm-hmm. 10 of the big coalfield counties. And the legislature finally tried to deal with this issue, so they created an Office of Blasting. Mm-hmm. And they only appropriated $100,000 for the Office of Blasting to regulate 311,000 tons of explosives a year.
Wow.
The other thing is creates lost property value for these people. You know, if you have a, of course, most of these people are poor, but if you had a $100,000 home near one of these sites, and immediately when that site gets permitted, your property value goes down. Mm-hmm. And what a lot of these coal companies have done is, rather than face the bad publicity of rock being blown into people's houses and people losing their wells, and what they'll do is they'll buy out whole communities. And in one case, they bought out a community, and there was an article in the Charleston Gazette where these people, when they were bought out, were forced to sign an agreement not to criticize mountaintop removal, which was proven to be against the law.
Right.
They asked them to give up their freedom of speech there. There's one activist who, family cemetery is on Kafer Mountain, and it's surrounded by mountaintop removal jobs, and he has a picture of a rock, it's called fly rock, size of a Volkswagen that flew into his yard.
Wow.
And it's just incredible, these explosions.
Wow.
And if you saw the 60 Minutes report, they had a shot at one of those explosions, and it's just incredible.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said that the state seems to be in support of this mountaintop removal, but why is that? I mean, what's their angle on it?
Well, what you got to understand is, for 100 years, West Virginia has been pretty much like a third world country. Most of the land in West Virginia has been owned by large out-of-state interests who come in here and take our natural resources. And they have also controlled our government and our politics. And just to give you an idea, Cecil Underwood is our governor. And he was one time vice president of Island Creek Coal Company.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to refer to another issue here to make a point. There's West Virginia has a $1.3 billion unfunded liability in its workman compensation program. In other words, we're $1.3 billion in debt. And most of that is because these coal companies don't pay their workman's compensation premiums. When he became governor, when Cecil Underwood became governor, he appointed the former director of workman's compensation for Island Creek Coal as workman's compensation director for the state of West Virginia.
Wow.
And his first act was to dismiss $200 million in unpaid workman's compensation premiums by five coal companies. And guess what? Island Creek Coal was dismissed to the tune of $45.6 million in unpaid premiums. And, of course, Cecil Underwood was vice president one time, and this workman's compensation director for the state of West Virginia once worked for Island Creek Coal. So, you know, our politicians are controlled by coal companies.
So do they bother to try to justify and make it sound as if their support of mountaintop removal is in everyone's interest?
Yeah, and what they point to is a couple of things. One, they point to jobs. Mm-hmm. In 1977, when strip mining started, there were 66,000 coal miners in West Virginia in underground mines. Now there are only about 15,000 miners. Mm-hmm. Only about 1,800 of those miners have jobs in mountaintop removal jobs. Well, let's go back to this figure. 1977, 66,000 miners. Now 15,000 miners. So the amount of miners has decreased by, it's one-third of what it was 20 years ago. But coal production has doubled in the same time. Mm-hmm. And what has happened is the technology that they use to do mountaintop removal has allowed them to mine more coal with less miners. And so there are actually less jobs. And there's a lot of underground miners who are very upset about this issue.
Right.
And we'll point something else out to you. In the 1980s, to give you an idea of how controlled state politics are by coal companies, in the 1980s, the West Virginia Coal Association went to the legislature and asked them for a technology tax credit. And the idea was if they used technology to create jobs, they could write it off as a tax break. Well, what they did was they started buying these big mountaintop removal machines, which put miners out of work, and they got $180 million in super tax in technology tax credits in the 1980s. So that argument doesn't fly. The next argument they use is the coal industry leaves so much money in the state. It creates spinoff jobs. They leave a lot of money from the coal in the state. Well, the fact of the matter is, and this comes from their own figures, that 41 cents out of every dollar worth of coal that's mined in West Virginia leaves the state. You know, I think the argument can be made that the United States became an industrial power or a world power as the result of the Industrial Revolution. And if you look at what fueled the Industrial Revolution, it was coal. It fueled the auto industry, fueled both war efforts, fueled the steel industry. And, you know, West Virginia, most of that coal came from West Virginia. Mm-hmm. And West Virginia is still 49th or 50th in every major category you want to look at. Wages earned, kids going to college. We still don't have roads in these southern coalfield counties. We don't have sewage systems. So if coal was really good for West Virginia, we, you know, a lot of the infrastructure, school system, and jobs would be better.
Right.
But it's not. It's all, they've just stolen it from us.
Or it might be good for some people in West Virginia, but not for other people.
Right.
Owners of the coal companies are. Now, you talked about the state government response. Maybe you could tell us about the federal response. I mean, what have the U.S. West Virginia's U.S. senators done about this? Has the Clinton administration done anything about this?
Well, the Senator Robert Byrd, who's a very powerful senator who for 40 years was head of the Senate Appropriations Committee and the ranking senator on the Appropriations Committee, his first response was to change the law. And in fact, he drafted language in a totally different bill and inserted it in a totally different bill that had nothing to do about strip mining or mountaintop removal or anything. Just inserted language in an appropriations bill and threatened to filibuster if that language didn't get through. And the whole West Virginia congressional delegation did the same thing.
How did he want to change the law?
He wanted to change the law so that you could fill in these streams. Mm-hmm. And you know, Senator Byrd is a great orator and proponent of the democratic process. And it's ironic that he wanted to slide this rider in on a totally unrelated bill without having debate about it. I mean, if they want to change the law, then there needs to be debate about it. But this was a terrible way to do it. And he caught a lot of criticism for that for people. Initially, Senator Byrd had enough votes to get this through the Senate, even though 20 Western Republican senators signed a letter saying they were against this.
Mm-hmm.
But No one knew whether the Clinton administration was going to veto it or not. And at first, it looked as if the Clinton administration was going to let it slide through. And then the whole national environmental movement got behind this issue. Mm-hmm. World Wildlife Fund, all the Sierra Club, all the national environmental movements, and went to Clinton and said, you can't do this. So he basically sent the message that he would veto it. But at the same time, looks like the Justice Department may be in the process of intervening in an appeal of Judge Hayden's decision in favor of the coal companies in the state of West Virginia. So it's very confusing mm-hmm. regard to that.
Maybe you could tell us about that court case that you mentioned.
Okay, well, I mentioned the court case. The state's largest environmental group filed suit, and they won the court case. And the court case originally, as a result of the court case, they were going to have to stop doing these large valley fills. Well, there was such an uproar about it that the Judge Hayden stayed the ruling, which meant that they could continue the valley fills until an appeal was filed because the state's going to appeal it. And they basically have no legal grounds to appeal it on, but they're going to appeal it. And just to tell you, it's a little ironic. What this court case centered around was Arch Coal, which is one of the world's largest coal producers, had applied for a permit to mountaintop removal Kafer Mountain, a 5-square-mile permit, okay, that we're going to take. It's going to take up 5 square miles, strip 5 square miles of a mountain. Kafer Mountain was the site, a lot of people in West Virginia know this, but maybe not outside of West Virginia. It was the site of the mine wars, the West Virginia mine wars. It was the largest civil insurrection since the Civil War. There were 10,000 Union men on one side and 10,000 either company men or National Guard, state police on the other side. And in the southern coal fields, the union was trying to get started, and the coal companies and the state government, and for that matter, the federal government, called them a bunch of Reds, a bunch of communists, and they wanted that stopped. And it came to a head, and there were cannons, there were bombs dropped. And this, you know, Kafer Mountain is the site of that. Mm-hmm. And as a result of this battle of Kafer Mountain, even though the miners backed down at this battle, it was the start of the United Mine Workers in this state. And, you know, people finally got some decent working conditions and wages. And it's ironic that they wanted to strip this mountain. Mm-hmm. And by the way, A West Virginia politician, Ken Heckler, who was, he's the Attorney General of the state of West Virginia right now. He's 85 years old. He's a decorated war veteran. He was a U.S. congressman for the state of West Virginia, very instrumental in getting the 1977 Surface Mine and Reclamation Act passed. He participated here recently in a commemorative march of the Battle of Blair Mountain, and he was heckled and assaulted by coal miners, actually physically assaulted, kicked, pushed, shoved for his opposition to mountaintop removal. Mm-hmm. He's been the only state official other than Bill Maxey, the head of forestry, to come out against this.
So the people who assaulted him were coal miners involved in mountaintop removal, not the ones who've
right.
been laid off
and,
from underground
right,
coal mining.
Right? Right. And coal miners put up to it by company,
right.
by corporations.
Right. What kind of organizing has been going on around these issues at the grassroots level?
Well, there's always been a environmental movement in West Virginia, and the environmental movement in West Virginia, a lot of times is portrayed as the state government and corporations like to portray the environmental movement as a bunch of do-gooders. A lot of times they say they're just out-of-staters and people that have moved here. But that's not true. Much of this movement has been by people in the coal fields. you know, poor people that don't have a lot of resources that are just fed up with this. And coal miners, ex-coal miners, people whose family have worked in the coal mines or who do work for the coal mines. And so it's been a blend of, you know, educated college people to, you know, poor disenfranchised families that are really affected by it. And it's really been something that's solidified the environmental movement in the state. But it's not just an environmental issue because, I mean, these companies have raped our state for 100 years. And that's one thing, and that's an environmental issue. It's one thing for them to do that, but it's another thing for them to rape our state and not leave anything behind. So it's a social justice issue that they not only rape our state, but they rob it too.
Mm-hmm. Randy, can you tell our listeners where they can find out more about this issue of Mount Top removal?
Well, if you go to the internet at www.wvgazette.com. They can go. There's a whole series by Ken Ward, who I said before has won 10 national journalistic awards for his articles on this. There's a whole series of issues about articles about this. That's www.wvgazette.com.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for speaking with us.
Okay.
Today.
All right. Great.
I have no shame, I feel no sorrow, if on this earth not what I own.
WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
My sweet children, an old plow mule, shovel and day hoe. When all wind will it be over, when will Alley burns down, and when I die, dear Lord in heaven, please take my soul, make that cold dark ground.
Next, we will hear audio excerpts from All Shaken Up, a video about mountaintop removal coal mining. In the summer of 1998, Bob Gates and Penny Loeb interviewed 45 West Virginia residents affected by mountaintop blasting for coal. In what follows, you will hear what some of those West Virginians had to say about how the nearly daily blasts, or shots as they call them, have affected their homes and communities.